A distinctive component of any frontier fort was the group of wives who managed to stay with their husbands, often under the most appalling conditions. And Fort Garner was blessed with two of the finest. The mud huts had scarcely been roofed over when Louise Reed, the commander's wife, and Bertha Wetzel, wife of the senior infantry officer, appeared in a cargo wagon which they had commandeered at Jacksboro. Mrs. Reed brought her 10-year-old daughter, who reveled in the ride across the plains, and such household gear as she and Mrs. Wetzel could assemble, not only for their own families, but for all the others at the fort. When the two women drove onto the parade grounds, men cheered, for those long associated with the four companies were well acquainted with the contributions such energetic wives made to soldiering, and within 2 days evidences of improved conditions were seen. Mrs. Reed gave a tea at which the 8 officers and the 4 wives were present, and on the next day Mrs. Wetzel carried her teapots to Sud's Row, where she assured the washerwomen that if they had any problems with the men, they would find support from her. She served them sandwiches and called each by name. The two women were remarkably similar. Each was a little taller than average, a little thinner. Mrs. Reed was from her husband's state of Vermont. Mrs. Wetzel had met her German husband when he was stationed at a fort in Minnesota. Each had a strong affiliation with her Protestant church, and each was painfully aware that her husband was probably going to remain in his present rank for as long as he wore the uniform. They were about the same age, too, in their early 30s, and whereas neither could ever have been termed beautiful, each had acquired from years of service that noble patina which comes from dedication to duty and the building of a good home. One enlisted man who had never spoken directly to the commander's wife said, "The 2 good days at a new fort, when we put a roof over where we sleep, and when Mrs. Reed appears." In the post-war period, she had helped make life easier at 3 different forts as the army moved resolutely west. And although this was the poorest site of the lot, she observed with pleasure that the land was flat and easy to manage, and the water supply copious. The rest will come in due time. One factor at Fort Garner displeased her. Johnny Miner, one of the best leaders of cavalry, and a man who already bore a heavy burden because he was required to lead black troops, had a pretty little wife named Nellie, who gave him much trouble. She despised his assignment and humiliated her husband's black cavalrymen by refusing ever to speak to them. To her, they did not exist, except when she was talking with the other wives. Then she called the Buffalo soldiers "those apes," and lamented that it was they who prevented Johnny from gaining the promotions he deserved. Mrs. Reed would not tolerate such dissension, and halted Nellie whenever it began. But Mrs. Wetzel, so admirable in other respects, shared her husband's deep distrust of colored troops. "Colonel Wetzel tells me constantly when we talk at night of how irresponsible they are. He says it's bad enough to serve with cavalry." At the most inappropriate times, she would forcefully proclaim her husband's harsh theories about the cavalry. And I mean any cavalry, not just the unfortunate Negroes. "The colonel tells me, horses require so much fodder, and this must be carried along in so many wagons, that the cavalry winds up doing nothing but riding happily along, guarding its own train. In fight after fight, the poor infantry is far ahead, doing the dirty work, while the cavalry lags behind, bringing up its food." Mrs. Reed, wife of an infantry officer, believed that most of what Mrs. Wetzel said was true. The cavalry really is a most wasteful branch. But she also knew that to keep peace in the fort, this constant barrage of criticism must be silenced, or at least muffled. So she cautioned her friend against blatant disparagement. For some days Mrs. Wetzel kept quiet, but she was a Scandinavian, well educated by her parents, who found it impossible to remain silent when she saw error. And one afternoon, when most of the officers and all the wives were present, she erupted. "It's a known fact that during the first days of a campaign against the Indians, the cavalry is most daring, dashing here and there. But we rarely encounter Indians during those first days, and soon the cavalry horses are worn down so that they can barely keep up with the infantry. And by the end of the second week, the horses are so tired they cannot keep up. On all days after that, the foot soldiers have to make camp early and sit there waiting for the cavalry to drift in. From the 12th day on, they're really useless, for not only are they exhausted, but they've also used up all their fodder. "Why do we bother with them?" young Andrew Masters from Illinois asked. And Mrs. Wetzel replied with more insight than she suspected, "Because generals like to ride horses at 4th of July parades." This was too much for Louise Reed. "This talk must stop, and it must not be resumed in my house. My husband is commander of a mixed unit, mixed in all ways, and it must remain harmonious." The attention of the two senior women was diverted from the deficiencies of the cavalry to the more exciting behavior of young Nellie Minor, who found time heavy on her hands while her husband was off on an extended scout with his black horsemen. On the first afternoon, she arranged an uneasy tea for the other wives. On the second, she took the Reed daughter on a canter along the Brazos River. And on the third, following the good example set by Mrs. Wetzel, she went down to Sud's Row to encourage the women there. But she was repelled by the conditions in which they worked, and could find nothing in common to talk about. On the fourth day, she saddled one of the horses reserved for wives, and planned her informal saunter along Bear Creek, in such a way that she had a good chance of encountering the Irishman Jim Logan as he returned from a morning canter to the north. They did meet, well apart from the fort, and they rode for several exhilarating miles back toward Jacksboro. They did not dismount, but each was aware of considerable electricity in the air, for as Nellie observed as they rode side by side, "It's like the quiet before a summer thunderstorm." Actually, it was well into the winter of 1870, but she was correct in feeling that great events impended. For not only was her attraction to this dashing Irishman becoming known at the fort, but Comanche to the west were about to become active again. On this afternoon, neither she nor Jim Logan was much concerned about Indians, for when they dipped down behind a small hill to the Larkin tank, where no one could see them, she rode very close to him, saying as they moved slowly across the grassy plain, "You ride extremely well." "My father taught me, in Ireland." "What's Ireland like?" "Greener than this." "Do you miss it?" "We starved." "Were you brave in the war?" "I knew how to handle horses. I knew how to fight. So they made me a major." "I know. Do you mind being a lieutenant now?" "Wars come and go. I was lucky to have found mine young. But to tell you the truth, Mrs. Minor, I don't feel unlucky to be a lieutenant during the long years." He turned sideways and smiled, a ravishing, honest smile. "My level, even in war, was just about captain. I was never meant to be a major, wasn't entitled, but I'm a damned good lieutenant." She leaned over and kissed him. "You're a captivating man, Major, and in my mind you'll always be a major." He grasped at her arm, holding her close to him for a protracted kiss. And each knew at that moment that if either made even the slightest motion toward dismounting, there would be a frenzied scene among the sagebrush. But neither made such a move, and gradually they worked their way back toward Bear Creek, along which they rode with feigned unconcern, until the fort became barely visible on the far horizon. "Shouldn't you ride in alone?" Logan suggested, and she agreed that this might be prudent. But before they parted, she moved close again and kissed him even more passionately. "I long to be with you, Jim." But he said simply, "Johnny's my superior, you know." So she rode directly to the fort while he made a far swing to the east, coming in much later on the Jacksboro Road. But such maneuvers fooled no one. Fort Garner quickly knew it had a dangerous love affair on his hands, and Mrs. Reed did not propose to have some young snippet, bored with frontier life, imperil her husband's already difficult command. As always, she went directly to the source of potential trouble. Or rather, she summoned the source to her quarters. "Nellie, sit down. It's my duty, as an older woman and as the wife of the commander, to warn you that you are playing a very dangerous game. But I seek none of your shabby excuses. Nellie, at the fort in Arkansas, you behaved the same way, and you came very close to ruining 3 careers. I shall not allow you to imperil my husband's command. Stay away from Major Logan."
"I haven't."
"Not yet, but you intend to."
"How can you talk like this? I'm not obligated."
"You're obligated to conduct yourself properly when you're in my husband's command." She said this with such accumulated force of character that Nellie blanched. "I will endanger no one," she said softly.
"Nellie, can't you find happiness with your husband? He's a splendid man. My husband cherishes him."
"He works with niggers, and he smells of niggers, and he can never amount to anything." Very harshly, Mrs. Reed said, "If you believe that, Nellie, you must leave this fort today." When the sniffling younger woman tried to speak, Mrs. Reed silenced her. "I said, today." Her voice rose. "Pack your things while I stand over you and leave this fort, because if you stay, you can bring only tragedy."
"I can't go. I have nowhere to go."
She began to weep. Mrs. Reed did not attempt to console her. Instead, she waited for the tears to halt, and then she asked, flatly, but also with obvious compassion,
"So what shall we do?"
"We?"
"Yes. This is as much my problem as yours."
"I can't go. I have nowhere, I tell you." "Then I shall tell you what you must do. Love your husband. Help him as Mrs. Wetzel and I help ours. Take pride in his accomplishments, which are many. And stay clear of Jim Logan."
"Will you tell the others?"
"The others told me." Now she softened. "Nellie, I'm always the last woman on the post to know what's happening to the wives in my husband's command. Believe me, I do not look for trouble. I castigate no one. But when trouble is brought to my attention so blatantly that I cannot—" She hesitated, choked, and had to fight back her own tears. "Nellie, I think we should pray." And the two officers' wives, there at the remotest outpost of their civilization, knelt and prayed. When they rose, Mrs. Reed took Nellie's hand and said, "Whoever promised you that an army officer's life would be pleasant? Believe me, this storm which assails you now will pass."
"I am torn apart, Mrs. Reed."
"Have you ever sat in a lonely fort with snow about the door and watched your child die? That's being torn apart, and even that storm passes."
"I shall try."
"And I shall—" She wanted to say either, "I shall pray for you," or "I shall watch you," but she knew that each was inappropriate and inaccurate. So she did not finish her promise, because what she proposed doing was much more practical. She would ask her husband to keep his young Irish cavalryman absent from the fort as often as possible, and on missions of maximum duration. Among the men on the frontier who followed the establishment of Fort Garner with close attention was a small, scrawny fugitive with watery blue eyes and a somewhat withered left arm. He lurked in Santa Fe, waiting for any good chance that would enable him to slip back into his preferred Texas. His name was Amos Peavine, and his ancestors had prowled the neutral ground, that bandit's no-man's land bordering old Louisiana. As a young man with a bad arm, he had had to be more clever than most, and had soon built a reputation throughout East Texas as a hold-up man and a ruthless killer. He was so devious, so quick to strike, that men started calling him Rattlesnake, and some, to their quick dismay, tried shooting at him. But he, well aware of his disability, had trained himself so assiduously in the use of guns that it was always he who drew first, fired first, and nodded ceremoniously as his would-be assailant fell.
Frontier gunman, noticing his affected left arm, assumed that it played no part in his behavior, but they were wrong. Through long practice, Rattlesnake Peavine could bring that bad arm up across his belt, providing a rock-like platform on which to rest the gun as it was being fired. And the action was so swift and smooth that even close watchers could not detect exactly what had happened. In those hectic days, he began to carry two Colts, and since his left hand was practically useless, he slung them both on his right hip, the only gunman known to do so. He spent about a year, 1863, perfecting holsters for his two guns, and then another, 1864, in shortening the barrels to make the guns easier to swing loose. This made his draw a fraction of a second quicker than that of a challenger. He also invented a clever way of making the trigger more responsive to his right forefinger. He filed down each sear until even a whisper would release it. Peavine did not notch his guns to keep track of their effectiveness. He was content to be known as that little bastard, about 130 pounds, who can shoot faster than a rattlesnake strikes and more deadly. At 19, he was an authentic Texas bad man. During the war, he had ranged the northern border, siding now with the Union forces, more often with the Confederate, but proving so unreliable to each that in the end both armies were trying to hang him, and it was then that he felt it advisable to quit Texas. "I got me a passel of enemies in this state. North or south, they don't realize a man is entitled to make a living. No future for me here." What was more persuasive? "Hell, come peace, they ain't much goods moving. A man ain't got much chance to pick a few bundles off for hisself." He had drifted slowly toward Santa Fe, on the principle, "A man can't make it in Texas, he can always succeed in New Mexico." And after trying vainly to profit from the exposed trade with Mexico, he discovered that the real money was to be made in a trade centuries old and infamously dishonorable. The Plains Indians wanted whiskey and rifles, and generations of disreputable traders had found profitable ways of supplying them. Spaniards had done so in the 1600s, Frenchmen in the 1700s, Mexicans in the first years of the 1800s, and now a wily crew of adventurers from Kentucky, Mississippi, and Texas continued the tradition. Amos Peavine was the most daring of the bunch, for he traded with the most deadly of the tribes. He was a Comanchero, a lawless man who roamed the Comancheria, that vast expanse of wasteland which coincided with the Buffalo Range. Especially he worked the Texas Plains, and when he learned that a new fort was to be established on Bear Creek, he rejoiced, because, although it brought more soldiers into the area, which meant a greater chance that he would ultimately be shot, it also brought two developments extremely favorable to him. The Indians under attack would have to have more guns, and the slow military trains crossing the empty plains carrying guns and ammunition would be more open to attack. A really crafty Comanchero stole guns from the army, sold them to the Comanche, then served as tracker for the army when it went out to confront the well-armed Indians. A Comanchero prospered in troubled times and was adept at devising strategies for keeping them troubled. While Mrs. Reed was lecturing young Mrs. Minor on proper behavior at a frontier fort, Rattlesnake Peavine was some 200 miles to the west, astride a winded old horse, and leading a Rocky Mountain burro he had obtained from a Mexican family by the persuasive process of shooting the entire clan in one unbroken fusillade. He was on a mission fraught with a medley of dangers, and any man who was afraid of nature, Indians, or the retaliation of the United States Army would have blanched at what faced him as he probed the empty plains, seeking contact with Chief Matark of the Comanche. Scorpions and snakes awaited him if he was careless when he dismounted. Death from dehydration got those who missed their water holes, so infrequent and so hot and alkali-ridden when found. Indian tribes at war with the Comanche would surely kill him if they caught him, and he faced equal danger from Comanche, to whom he could not identify himself quickly. And there were always new forts with energetic new commanders eager to take up the chase against any despised Comanchero.
Amos Peavine, threading his way through these encroaching disasters, was a brave man, almost a heroic one. For the forces of evil require just as much strength of will as do the angels of goodness. It is only the force of character that is missing. Peavine had enormous will. He had no character at all, not even a consistently bad one. For, as in the old days of 1861 to 65, he stood willing to trade with anyone, to betray everyone. Now he had a promising scheme, which might produce substantial profits if acted upon swiftly. But before action could take place, he had to find Matark. He had left New Mexico, haven for Comancheros like himself and other bandits who ravaged Texas, and had entered that refuge known throughout the West as the Palo Duro Canyon. It was a formidable depression, more than 100 miles long, dug through solid rock by millions of years of active water, and so lonely and awesome that white men rarely tried to penetrate or conquer it. Those who did saw sights that were majestic. High walls of colored rock hemmed in valleys of surprising richness, where a man could herd 1,000 cattle and be assured that they could feed themselves on the evergreen grasses, but not escape from the natural corral which kept them penned. Cattlemen were not able to try this experiment because the Comanche had reached Palo Duro first and had for more than 100 years utilized it as their one totally secure hiding place. Within the canyon, at about the center of its east-west reach, rose a pile of reddish rocks known as the Castle, and it was to this traditional meeting spot that Peavine was heading. He did not ride the well-marked path at the bottom of the canyon, for that would trap him in too dangerously. He kept instead to the less comfortable trail along the south rim, because from here he could look down into the rocky depths and also across to the other side, for the canyon was not extensive in its north-south dimension. And now, as he led his complaining burro along the trail from which the castle should soon be visible, he was satisfied that he had once more negotiated the canyon and brought himself into contact with the Indians he sought. There was, of course, still the possibility that he might encounter some idiot lieutenant from one of the forts, out seeking glory, who had boasted to his troop as he led his cavalry out, "I shall invade Palo Duro and bring back the scalp of Chief Matark." Often such a man would utter an extra vow, "And I'll rescue Emma Larkin," for she was constantly on the conscience of these soldiers. Peavine laughed as he thought of the men within the forts. "Better they stay home. Come up here to these walls, they're going to get shot." Various expeditions had come to grief at Palo Duro, and it seemed likely that more would follow. "These canyons will be Indian for a long time," Peavine muttered, as he saw the familiar signs which indicated that the castle was not far off. He was justified in using the plural canyons, because each small stream that fed the main architecture of this deep cut had gouged out its own smaller canyon, so that at the center, where he now rode, the land became a jumble of lateral cuts, some so deep that they could not be traversed if Peavine kept to the upper plateau. So, crossing himself as if he were a believing Catholic, he edged his tired horse toward the rim, tugged at the rope guiding his burro, and started down the steep and rocky path to the lower level. He was now at the most dangerous point of his 200-mile expedition, for he rode so close to the wall of the canyon that any rattlesnake, awakening from his winter sleep, could strike him full in the face if it darted forth. Also, if either enemy Indians or roving troops were setting a trap, here is where they would spring it. But this time he made his descent peacefully, and when he gained the floor of the canyon, he found himself once more in a congenial fairyland which he had known in the past. Land about the castle leveled out, and produced such a richness of grass, such protection from storms, and had such an equable climate, cool in summer, warm in winter, that it formed a kind of Indian Garden of Eden. Here, within this security, some squaws, more adventurous than their sisters, even tried growing vegetables from seeds captured on raids against ranches. Turning a familiar corner, Peavine waved to the scouts he knew would be watching, licked his lips in preparation for the Comanche words he would soon be speaking, and headed his horse toward the Indian encampment. It was an amazing collection of teepees,
for in their travels south from their original Rocky Mountain homeland, the Comanche had acquired a variety of housing, some with tall cedar poles lifting the buffalo hide covering high into the air. These were the Cheyenne contribution. And others, little more than rounded huts, depending not upon long poles, but bent branches for their form, a pattern used by the Ute. Most notable were the small, compact teepees built about a minimum of moderately long poles. These were some of the best, a device of the Pawnee. The Comanche, a wandering tribe that had developed only a limited culture of its own, had borrowed types of teepees from everyone. Their fierce courage and their appalling cruelty to any captive, they themselves invented. "I seek great Chief Matark," Peavine cried loudly as he entered the haphazard arrangement of teepees. And he repeated the announcement until a group of young braves ran over to surround him, leaving behind the half-naked creature they had been tormenting. "Is that the Larkin girl?" he asked, as the young men came up. And they looked back, as if bewildered that anyone should care who the child was. They had already burned off her ears, and her nose would disappear before the summer was out. She was 13 now, a most pitiful thing. But miraculously, she retained enough intelligence to know that the arrival of a white man, any white man, meant that her chance of rescue was, by that small degree, enhanced. She took a tentative step toward Peavine, praying that he would take notice of her. But he looked the other way, and two of the young men grabbed stones and threw them at her with great force, shouting as they did so, "Get back!" Matark and his four wives occupied a large teepee in the Cheyenne style, its cedar poles emitting a pleasing fragrance. It had a low entrance, requiring the visitor to stoop. But inside it was spacious and festively decorated with elkskin hangings, on which had been depicted in various colors the history of this portion of the tribe. Matark himself, tall and brooding, was a striking figure whose command over his men was understandable. Obviously he had a superior intelligence, which he began to display immediately. "What new thing brings you here?" he asked. "Word from St. Louis." "What word?" "Kevin and Clark, they've been hired to carry guns, many guns and all ammunition, to the new fort at Bear Creek."
"Oh!"
Matark did not try to hide the weight and pleasure he accorded such news. To attack successfully one train of this probable magnitude would supply him with armament for 3 years. But he was suspicious where white men were involved, and he asked, "If you know this, the guns, aren't they already there?" "The system, Chief. You know the system." And the plotters had to laugh at the incredible stupidity of the United States Army, which placed men like Captain Reed in remote outposts like Fort Garner, then gave them no authority over or responsibility for their supplies. Desk officers in Washington, inordinately jealous of their prerogatives and aware that their jobs were safe only if constantly enhanced, had prevailed upon Congress, at whose elbows they sat while men like Reed battled Indians, to initiate one of the stupidest plans in military history. Every item shipped to Fort Garner was requested not by the man on the scene, but by some desk officer 2,000 miles away. And when it was authorized, belatedly, another desk officer in another building in Washington decided when and by whom it would be railroaded from the depot in Massachusetts to the warehouse in St. Louis, and by what frontier carter it would be finally dispatched to the intended recipient. Because the desk officer in charge of transportation sought a carrier who charged the least or bribed the most, he usually employed some carter with the least reliable drivers and the least expensive horses, and none was more deficient than Cabin and Clark in St. Louis. Cargoes consigned through them sometimes required half a year to cover 500,000 miles, and when they arrived, there would always be shortages due to the C&C driver's tricky habit of selling off portions to storekeepers en route. So when Rattlesnake Peavine told Chief Matark that the guns for Fort Garner were being shipped by Cabin and Clark, the Indian knew that anyone who sought to intercept this shipment had plenty of time. There was even the possibility that gunfire from ambush might not be necessary, because it was sometimes possible for a Comanchero to arrange an outright deal with the C&C driver. I'll give $200 for the whole train. Could you buy the guns? Martark asked. They know me too well. I killed two of their drivers. Then we must capture them? I think it's the only way. Will the wagons have an escort? Probably. A new fort, a new commander. And eager young officers, Martark said. Well, I'll send my eager young braves. When I entered the canyon, Peavine said, I saw your young fellows playing with a white girl. Could that be the Larkin girl? Yes. You know, I could earn you a lot of money if you'd let me trade her back to the Texans. I have plans for her, Martark said. And you're right. She'll bring us a lot of money. Then I can't have her? Before the chief could reply, the wily trader explained, Someday I'll have to make peace with the Texans. No more trading. Too old. If I appeared with the Larkin girl, I'd be a hero. Martark looked at him and thought, Yes, and then you'd turn against us. It would be you, the rattlesnake, who would lead the bluecoats against us. You'd bring them right into this canyon. For one savage moment, he considered calling for his braves and killing Peavine right then. But the canny little trader divined his thinking and quickly said, You know you need me. To keep getting guns, you need me. I do, Martark conceded. And a deal was firmed whereby Peavine would get many Mexican pieces of gold if the guns were captured. But when he left Montark's tent, he took great care to seek out Emma Larkin, for if she was ever released, he wanted her to testify to the fact that he had tried to be helpful. He found her huddled in the shade of a teepee, ignored for the moment by her tormentors, and he was appalled by her appearance. She was thin, almost to the point of death, her hair and nails filthy. Only knotted nubs remained to show where her ears had been, and her nose was in fearful condition. Looking at her as she trembled by the teepee, he wondered how the Comanche had fallen into the abominable practices they followed with their prisoners, and he recalled having chided Martark about this. Why do you burn the ranchers alive? Why cut them to pieces? And the chief had replied, That's our custom. Peavine then asked, Why not just kill them? And Martark had said, To watch an enemy die is good. Peavine said, But why torture them so? And Martark had explained, If enemy dying is good, long time dying is better. Peavine had inquired further, Does it mean something? Does it add strength to your braves? And Martark had said with solemn finality, It has always been our custom. That explained so much, not only regarding the Comanche, but all fighting men. And Peavine, reflecting on the customs of his own profession, could hear his father admonishing him, Never shoot a man in the back. Never. It ain't tolerated. It was also not tolerated to kill women, unless in the heat of battle, or when they were shooting back. Texans, he noticed, bore no grudge if a man shot another with a rifle, even if from ambush at a safe distance. But they deplored the Mexican who killed with a knife, even at close hand where he ran great risk. The gun was manly, the knife was not. French, German, Russian armies, he had heard, all had their traditions as ironclad as the Comanche attitude toward prisoners. He had been told of the Prussian custom of leaving a disgraced officer alone with a loaded revolver, expecting him to blow his brains out. Not with me. They got to do the shootin', he growled. But no rationalization could justify the Comanche treatment of their girl prisoners. Why do you let them do such horrible things to the little girls? He had asked Martark, who had again replied, It is our custom. Peavine had not liked being allied with Indians who behaved so barbarously. But with the plains depleted of other tribes, he had few options. And hiding his disgust, he moved closer to the girl, whereupon a transformation took place. For when she looked up at him, she was no longer a terrified object of torture.
she was a fighting little tiger with the same determination to survive that animated him. This child was not going to die easily, regardless of what the Comanche did to her. And for a fleeting moment he wanted to embrace her and carry her with him on the raid against the supply train. His life had taught him to revere persistence, and this child was persisting against terrors which would have deranged even strong adults. "My name is Amos Peavine," he said. "I wish I could help." These were the first words in English she had heard since the massacre, and she was obviously pleased that she remembered what they meant. "I am Emma Larkin." "I know. I will tell the others you are alive." "You," a surly brave shouted, "get back." And with a well-directed stone, he hit her sharply on the leg. Knowing that if she did not obey instantly, the tortures would resume, she scurried away as if she were a frightened dog. But Peavine, catching a glimpse of her eyes, realized that she was not frightened. She was acting so to be rid of the stone-throwing. And he muttered to himself, "Some night she'll cut that one's throat. Go it, lass." With that, he turned to the organizing of the raiding party, which would ambush the Cabin and Clark shipment. When Captain Reed received official notice from the young officer in Washington that his supplies, including needed guns and ammunition, would be arriving sometime in May via Cabin and Clark, he shuddered, because he knew that if C&C performed as always, the shipment might arrive in May as scheduled, but it also might arrive in September, or perhaps not at all. "I cannot understand," he complained to Wetzel, "how Washington can ignore our negative reports on Cabin and Clark and still use them." "Saving money," the German suggested. "But it loses money. We proved that in our last report." Men at the desk never believe men in the field. Reed said no more to Wetzel, who, in the great Prussian tradition, respected whatever the higher command ordered. But he did seek out his adjutant, Lieutenant Sanders. "I'm not easy about this Cabin and Clark shipment. What ought we do?" "We need those supplies. I'd send a detachment of cavalry to Fort Richardson. Protect the wagons every inch of the way from Jacksboro." "We've not been ordered to do so." "I'd do it anyway. Those are our goods, and we'd need them." "Who would you send?" "Well, the Comanche will probably be reluctant to strike so far behind our lines." Reed grew impatient. "You just said we had to protect the wagons." "I'm not afraid of the Comanche. I'm afraid of Cabin and Clark. If we don't watch them, they'll sell the whole consignment." The two officers shook their heads in disgust, and Reed spoke first. "Hell of a situation. We have to fight the Indians, we have to fight Cabin and Clark, and we have to fight Washington. But who to send?" "With Fort Richardson at the other end, the likelihood of a fight is not great. I'd send young Toomey." He reflected not on Toomey's ability, but on the terrain between the two forts. "Yes, I'd send Toomey. But I'd also send Sergeant Jaxifer. He knows the lay of the land." Sanders, although not a member of the 10th Cavalry, had had ample opportunity to assess the character of Jaxifer, a 43-year-old veteran of mounted action. He was a big, very black man, with almost no neck, and with forearms that could have wrestled bears. Surprisingly quick on his feet, he leaped into any action that confronted him, and on a horse was practically unstoppable. He said little, told no one what his antecedents were, and if asked, said New York was his home, even though the roster listed his birthplace accurately as Georgia. He had joined the Union forces in December 1863, after escaping from the Confederacy by swimming the Rio Grande into Mexico, and had attained the impressive rank of first sergeant through a mixture of quick obedience and obvious bravery. When Northern blacks who had never known slavery asked his opinion of the system, he said, "I had some bad masters, more good, but I run away from both." The fact that he was now surviving in an army which despised him was proof of his intelligence. He was harsh with his men. "This got to be the best unit in the army. You step out of line, I cut your neck off." Even Wetzel, who had objected to having the black cavalry so close to his white infantry at morning parade and evening retreat, occasionally complimented Jaxifer on the snappy drill his men performed. In the Prussian army, a lot more precision, of course, but very good by American standards. Once Wetzel even placed his hand on Jaxifer's arm as the two stood watching their men drill. "We have a first-class fort here. We can be proud." John Jaxifer was the kind of man one sent to reinforce a junior officer on a scouting expedition. But the importance of the proposed exercise was somewhat diminished when a group of four horsemen arrived from Fort Richardson with headquarters plans for the movement of Cabin and Clark wagons. "General Grierson will send some of our troops to protect it halfway. At Three Cairns, you'll take over and bring the train safely in." "We had stood ready to pick it up at Jacksboro," Reed said. But the other men assured him that Grierson was more than happy to extend the courtesy. "We have some young fellows who need the experience." "Likewise," Reed said. And it was arranged that 6 days after the Fort Richardson men started west, Second Lieutenant Elmer Toomey, supported by First Sergeant John Jaxifer, would ride toward Three Cairns, those informal piles of rock which had been stacked on the treeless plains, to mark the way to Fort Garner, to pick up the wagon train and bring it safely home. Chief Muttark and Amos Peavine had been kept informed of both the arrival of the CNC train at Jacksboro and the movement of a four-man escort west from Fort Richardson. "If they join up with the men from Fort Garner coming east to meet them," Muttark warned, "they might be too strong for us." But Peavine reassured him, "The Fort Richardson men will come only halfway, then ride back to Jacksboro. We'll have to fight only the small escort sent out by Fort Garner. If that, where do we attack?" "During the last half. Then the stronger force at Fort Richardson would have more difficulty sending help." Carefully, the two plotters analyzed the situation, with Peavine supplying the relevant details concerning army strength. 8 wagons, driver and shotgun each, that's 16 guns right there. But those CNC drivers don't like to fight. Real cowards. The Buffalo soldiers, they like to fight, and think 3 of them can lick 20 of us. Any crusty Comanchero like the Rattlesnake liked to use the pronouns we and us when talking with his Indians. Grierson, he'd send 4 men at most. Reed, this is his first fort as commander. He'll send maybe a dozen. But whereas Grierson would never send an untried man, not on any mission at all, Reed might. "More men in the second half?" Muttark asked. "But weaker?" Before Peavine could respond, a scout rode up, quivering with excitement, but also laughing. "Come see. You must see." And he led the two men nearly a mile south to where 2 other scouts were lying on the ground at the edge of a slight rise, below which nestled a small protected tank, near which a soldier whose blue jacket lay beside him was twisting on the ground with a young woman who looked as if she might be very pretty indeed. They were making love, and for a long moment the 5 watchers looked approvingly. "Shall we kill them?" one of the scouts asked. And each of the other 4 men thought how astonished those lovers would be if they were interrupted in their raptures by 4 Comanche and a white man with a withered left arm. The 3 braves were ready to make the charge down the slopes of the little vale when Peavine halted them. It would alert the fort. But they're so far away. They would be missed. Their bodies would be found. He spoke harshly. "It's the wagons we want." But as they rode away, he had to chuckle. Wouldn't they have been surprised? And he reined in his horse to look again at the lovers sprawled upon the ground in their secluded swale beside the tank.